Good afternoon. Welcome to the first fall meeting for the UI Faculty Senate. Jane, would you call the roll, please?
Hey, Albertson.
Present.
Baker.
Present. This is Victoria Baker. Tori Baker.
Okay, Tori, I think I hear you.
Okay, I'm on the audio. You got me now?
Yes, thank
okay.
you.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Barnes.
Present.
Thank you. Berge.
Here.
Did I say your name right?
Yeah. Okay.
Bret Hart.
Here.
I heard you, Donnie. C.
Here.
Chen. Anyone present for Cheng Fu Chen? Kaufman.
Here.
Condi.
Present.
And did I say your name correct?
Yep.
Cook.
Present.
David.
Here.
Dean. Duke. Anyone here for Rob Duke?
Dean is here.
No, no.
Oh, not you?
Nope.
Oh.
Fallon.
Sorry.
Fochisato. Anyone here for Javier? Gibson.
Here.
Gustafson. I saw Karen. She'll probably appear. Han. Chow-Chi Han. Hardy. There's here. Healy. Horstman.
Yep.
Johnson.
Here.
Johnston.
Here.
Jolly. Anyone here for Julie? Glenji Day, perhaps? No. Keeland. Keeland.
Ah, here.
Larden.
Here.
Love. Marr. McCartney.
Here.
Meyer.
I'm here for Franz. Franz okay. Meyer? Yeah.
Brian Rasley is here for Franz Meyer. Misra.
Here.
Moser. Okay. Liz Hummerkaus is here for Dennis Moser. Newberry. Bradenbow. Todd, Shawcross, Short,
here.
Valentine,
here.
Weber,
here.
Webley,
here.
Winfrey,
here.
Windsor, Peter Windsor, Yari. Jane. And Tony Rickard, is Tony here for United Academics?
He's not.
Okay. Libby Eddy, our registrar, is here. Brad Crick is here for Staff Council. Do we have anyone from ASUAF with us today? Isla or McKinley? Danny Shepard, here for athletics. And we have Dean Herman,
here.
Mark Herman. The chancellor is not here yet. Susan Hendricks, our provost, is here. And we have Eric Manson. Okay.
And 2 digits.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Thank you, Jane. Next on our agenda is to approve the minutes from our last meeting from last May. Are there any corrections to the minutes from last May? Any objections to their adoption? Hearing none, the minutes are adopted. Are there any changes, corrections, to the agenda before you for meeting 192, today's agenda. Any objections to their adoption? Hearing none, the agenda is adopted. The first thing I want to report on is the status of the Chancellor's Office actions. All of the motions that have come out of the Senate from last year have been approved by the Chancellor. There are no motions pending before the Chancellor's Office, so we are starting the year with a clean slate. Moving on to President's remarks, I just want to do a couple things. Start with a little bit of housekeeping. My intent in running these meetings is to try to move things at a fairly brisk pace. Faculty Senate meetings have a tendency to go a tad long, so I'm going to try to avoid doing that if at all possible. That being the case, I don't want to run over anyone, so please, if you need to be heard, if you haven't been heard, please let me know. The idea here is for this body to be a body in which your voice can be heard. And speaking of hearing your voice, you'll notice that there are microphones in front of you. The reason why they're there is not only so that we can hear each other in this room, the acoustics in here are pretty bad if you don't have a microphone. It's also so that the folks who are online, so please make an effort to remember to speak into your microphone whenever you're recognized. In order to kind of move things along, you'll notice at the end of the agenda there are several committee reports that are usually there. What I'm going to do is ask that the chairs of the committees feel free to report on anything that they think is particularly remarkable that should be voiced orally into the Senate record. Otherwise, we can just go with the minutes from your meetings that are in the end. Some suggestions on being an effective senator. I'm just going to basically go through a couple of things. You've all couple things. One is to bookmark the Faculty Senate website, which is uaf.edu/uafgov/faculty-senate. There is a huge amount of information on there, including audio recordings of previous meetings, the minutes from various committees, and so forth. So there's no reason to be in the dark about anything that's going on within the Senate. So make sure that you have that handy. Make sure you look over. I don't ask you to read it, but just at least be familiar with what's in the Faculty Senate Handbook, which is available on the Senate website, and you should all have gotten or will be getting soon a copy of that. And then finally, before every meeting, Jane Harvey puts out an email that alerts everyone to the agenda being available. Please, please, please have a look at the agenda. I don't expect you to actually read the whole thing, but it would help if you skimmed it and knew what kinds of motions were coming up. And the ones that pique your interest would be really helpful to have your input on rather than coming in completely cold. So please do that. And the last thing in my remarks at the beginning of the handbook, I point out that most of the Senate's work is really done in committee. Very rarely will a motion come to the floor that will actually get passed by the Senate without a great deal of hand-wringing and angst and so forth. The committees are the best place to do that sort of thing. So please try to be active within your committees and give your chairs the support that they need. Okay. I want to report on some committees. We have assigned all of our senators and other persons to existing standing and permanent committees. There is a possible new committee that we'll be talking about, and because of that, we're going to delay asking for your confirmation of committee until the October meeting. We have a couple of loose ends left over from last year, and I'm just going to make one brief mention of it, which is that last spring we began work, when I say we, I mean a group of people who didn't include me, on identifying interdisciplinary issues on the road or in the road to doing interdisciplinary research and teaching and I guess service as well. That committee has met and come up with a draft, which I've seen a couple that have been labeled final drafts, but I've also seen it get edited some additionally. I'm hoping that we'll have the final from that committee before the October meeting. We have a new committee that we'll be talking about a bit, well, No, I'm going to just talk about it now. As you probably know, the Cooperative Extension Service and the School of Natural Resources and Agricultural Sciences, in full disclosure, I'm a member of the latter unit, is on its way to being merged. The committee that is in charge of doing that has been, and I hope I'm not stepping on the provost's toes here, has been constituted by the provost, and the faculty senate got an appointee to that committee, and that appointee is Donnie Bretthart. So I want to thank Donnie for stepping up to doing that for us. The next thing I'd like to report on briefly is, as you may know, the faculty senate president, president-elect, and past president of our senate, along with our counterparts at UAA and UAS, all constitute a body called the Faculty Alliance. So it's the leadership from the three faculty senates of the three universities in the, of the three state universities in the state. And that group gets together on a monthly basis to go over issues of common concern to the three senates and the three faculties. And I wanted to briefly remark on some of the issues that came up, just so that you know that they're on the horizon, from our August retreat. The first is that there will be several priority projects that the Faculty Alliance is going to work on. The first of those is to develop the foundation for and ultimately have come into being a faculty regent. That would be a faculty member sitting on the Board of Regents. That would be selected from the faculty of somewhere in among the three universities. The Faculty Alliance has some representation on the statewide academic council. Cecile Larden, the president-elect, will be serving in that capacity. There were some strategic academic council meetings over the summer, and I participated in those. I wanted to report on a couple of those that came to the Faculty Alliance. The first is that there is a motion that has been proposed to the Faculty Alliance, and the Faculty Alliance will be taken to the three senates at some point, to adopt some sort of minimum baccalaureate admission standards. And the reason for this is that the looking at success data, people who make it through and get their degrees, there seems to be some pretty clear signs that people below a certain level of admissions capabilities, I guess, usually don't make it. And so it would be perhaps an ethical pathway for the three universities to at least say, okay, you are unlikely to succeed with the kind of application that you have, and so we would not admit people below a certain level of capabilities or demonstrated academic record. So that is in the pipeline. It's not ready for us to look at here, but the Faculty Alliance will be looking at that to figure it out when to come up with that, introduce that motion to the three senates. Similarly, the statewide academic council is recommending that we adopt some common cut scores for math placement. The Faculty Alliance will be considering that for a possible motion to the three senates. And finally, the statewide academic council is considering and is proposing changes allowing a bit more flexibility with respect to residency across the three universities. Those will be, again, talked about during the course of the year. The next issue that the Faculty Alliance is working on is to develop some principles and guidelines for managing the university in the universities in a tight fiscal climate. What sorts of faculty input do we want to have into that process to ensure that our voices are heard in an appropriate manner? We'll be talking with the chair of the Faculty Affairs Committee about taking a lead on that. There is another statewide Faculty Alliance committee, I like to call it the JELLO Committee, stands for General Education Learning Outcomes. It is meeting fairly regularly. We just had a teleconference this morning. It's moving towards adoption of a statewide set of general education learning outcomes. If you've been on the Senate long enough, you'll know that we adopted here at UAF some general education learning outcomes a couple of years ago, back in 2011. What, you might ask, is the relationship between what we did and this effort? The good news is that this committee started with our general education learning outcomes that this Senate adopted and has made, so far, some relatively minor tweaking changes. But as it stands, as of this morning, which is the chair of the committee feels like that's getting fairly close, reflects strongly the learning outcomes that we've adopted here. So I feel a bit optimistic about that. Okay. I can't avoid this. It's kind of boring, but I'm going to do it, despite the fact that I've been talking a lot already. We have a number of external committee reps, and I think it's useful to point out where those stand, because it's a way of acknowledging the work and also where we are with respect to these. I mentioned that the Sunray CES merger, the Faculty Senate rep will be Donnie Brethart. We have a vacancy in the Technology Advisory Board that was left open by the departure of the sabbatical of Orion Lawler. Peter Webley has agreed to step into that role, so thank you, Peter. We have a couple of committees that we usually have a representative on. The Naming Facilities Committee will be our representative to that will be Cecile. The Usavelli Awards Committee represented from the Senate will be me. Both of the last two are in keeping with previous Senate traditions. We have openings on the Parking Advisory Committee representation and for the GERC liaison, who I'm hoping will come from the Curricular Affairs Committee. Reiner and I are conversing about that occasionally. And finally, we have an opening on the Master Planning Committee. We've had a couple of student appeals that occurred over the summer, and I want to make mention of the people who are serving in those capacities. There was a grade appeals committee constituted with Chanda Meek and Atar Chowdhury being my appointees to that committee. Another was a student appeal. This is a program issue, and that was our representatives were Terry Quinn and Cecile Larden. Okay, with that, I conclude my remarks. Thank you for bearing with me. And we move on to the President-elect's remarks.
Just for clarification, on those external committees, do you want people to contact you if they're interested?
Yes, please. I'm sorry, I should have been explicit.
Okay. Okay, so I'm just going to keep it short. There are a couple of things that I would like to start working on. One is to make the work of the Senate a little bit more visible on campus. As you all know, things sort of happen here. We get all excited about them, but then they don't sort of seem to filter through the multiple layers. So I'd like to make all of that a little bit more visible. One way of doing that is for David and I to go to as many college convocations as we're invited to, and so far we have three invitations, CNSM, CLA, and the School of Education, which is great. And Jane, did we contact directors of institutes as well? Okay, all right. But so we put it out there that we're available to come. We already went to the beginning of the year, and it wasn't really a convocation; it was a work session for CRCD. And actually, that's kind of where the idea came from. We didn't go with that express purpose. There was an item. There were several Senate-related items on their agenda, and so Jane and I ended up going. David couldn't make it that day, and it just ended up being a good thing. We thought, we really need to go to all of these, or as many as we can, and make ourselves more visible. So that's one way. There'll be other ways. Another thing I'd like to work on, and this might be seen a little bit as barking at the moon, but I'm going to try anyway, and that is to kind of develop some ways to support committee chairs more and to kind of develop leadership within the Senate. There's, as the old-timers here know, there are years when nobody wants to step up to be the next president-elect, and that's not a good thing. And I think oftentimes that is because, you haven't had enough exposure.
it's hard to figure out whether you're going to have the time and whether there's enough support to do it. And so I think if we have some leadership support and development early on for people who are in the Senate, you know, for more than a term, I'm hoping that will kind of facilitate more interest in taking on leadership positions. But at the very least, I'm hoping it'll make committees function a bit more efficient. And that is not to say there are some committees that have been incredibly efficient for many years, thanks to both their members and their chairs, and some committees are struggling. So again, you know, I'd like to sort of figure out how to support committee chairs a bit more, and also how to kind of promote Senate service as something other than you can put it on your, you know, activities report for when you go up for promotion, so that more people can kind of see the value of what the Senate does, and we can do some recruitment. One addition to business from last year, as you know, there were actually two committees who worked on the Blue Book. We didn't quite get it done, but I'll be involved in getting that Blue Book done and to the floor of the Senate, so we have an updated version. There's one committee, an ad hoc committee on joint appointments that's working this semester, and that'll be crucial to revising the Blue Book. But there's some other sort of things that still need to be finalized. So hopefully we can get that to you by mid-year. That's all I've got.
Okay, thank you, Cecile. Any questions for either me or Cecile? Okay, the Chancellor is not here, so we'll go directly to the Provost's remarks.
The Chancellor tells me that he'll be here at 1:45, and I think he'll beg the Chair's indulgence to speak at that time. He told me that he would talk a bit about the FY14, FY15 budget situation, among other issues that he may wish to discuss. I'll just mention a couple of things relatively briefly. First of all, we're going to a broader launch of the Faculty 180 Annual Activity Reporting. Use of this software is not mandatory this year, but we would like everyone to try it, whether or not they eventually submit their official annual activity report using it. This is a very good time to get familiar with it, because we expect that it will be mandatory to use the software next year. We have a representative of the company coming up from October 6th to 8th, and if people have tried out the software by that time, there's a lot that we can do to interact with that representative. Representative will come to the Senate meeting, for example, to let the person know what changes, modifications, difficulties, and so forth that we're experiencing with the product. But the key is having people actually try to use it and thus gain the experience they need to know to ask the hard questions or the easy questions, as it may turn out to be, in terms of making the product the best possible one for people to use. Second thing I want to mention is that Eric Madsen is leading an effort to evaluate instructional assessment systems, electronic course evaluation systems, he and the committee that he was working with last year have narrowed the choice down to four leading contenders. And there's going to be an opportunity soon, in about the next month, for people to look at those four systems. We're recruiting a core group of people that's representative of units across campus to give these four systems an intense look, but we're interested in having anyone who wants to look at them. So there'll be various opportunities advertised for people to have a chance to look at the systems and decide whether they may meet our needs here at UAF. So that's pretty much what I have to say, and I'll pass the baton back.
Thank you, Provost Hendricks. Are there any questions for Provost Hendricks?
I just have kind of a general question, and maybe the Chancellor will speak to this. But last year you talked about setting up a committee to kind of look at programs and evaluate programs. And I know that President and President-elect were on that committee, and there was a number of programs were sort of prioritized and decided on which ones would be funded and their priority on the list. And I was just curious how that process is going to go forward in terms of in the future, given the fact that a set of priorities, there may be an elimination of programs. So I'm just curious how the Senate, how you see the Senate, envision the Senate being involved in that process.
Well, as has happened up to this point, there are a couple of ways in which broadly faculty and more in a more focused way the Senate is involved in the program review process. To take another step back, I'll be sending out memoranda to all the programs that were reviewed, I hope within the first month of the fall semester, letting them know what the outcome of the program review was relative to particular programs. There are not going to be huge numbers of program eliminations. There's going to be some reorganizations and so forth that's recommended as a result of the process. Anyway, getting back to your particular question, as people probably already know, the program review process involves three steps. One is first, a faculty, a representative faculty committee makes recommendations. Secondly, there's a committee of administrators, including deans and campus directors. And then thirdly, there is the chancellor's cabinet that makes the final determination of the outcome of program review. But in addition to that, in order to have program eliminations, the process comes back to the Senate. And that was illustrated with, for instance, the proposal to delete the math PhD that was changed into a trial period with efforts to improve the number of students in the program over the next several years. So that's the process, and it does have opportunities clearly for faculty input. But as we go forward, as the Chancellor may allude to in his remarks, we do have more financial challenges than we've had in the recent past. Changes in the taxation on oil production, just declining oil production, and our ever-increasing fixed costs are things that we have to consider, and we have to be able to operate the university in the black. It's not allowed for us to spend money that we don't have. So we are going to need to take a harder look at all of our activities, not just academic programs, of course. There are efforts similar to program review, but of course different in detail, going on now for all sorts of administrative services. They're ramping up a review of research programs, student services, and development activities, and basically everything that the university does is going to be subject to a process similar to program review.
Yeah, that's just a concern, I think, of CRCD faculty, a number of them that are term funded. They want to know what kind of process is going to go forward. So I'll look forward to watching that. Thank you.
Let me just add one other thing. Mike, I would welcome some involvement in the discussion about potential ways of having more faculty input into dealing with tight budgets. So I thank you for your input. Next on the agenda is Dean Mark Herman from the School of Management has asked to have a few minutes to talk about a proposal for changing the School of Management's tuition with respect to, with respect to current practice.
Okay, is this on? Can everybody hear me? Well, Dave and Cecile, thank you for having me today. I come at the suggestion of Chancellor Rogers, who thought it was a good idea if I give you a quick update on where the School of Management is with regard to differential tuition or tuition surcharge. So I think many of you probably heard that we are seeking this. So in short, the School of Management is asking for a differential tuition or a tuition surcharge of 25% over the current tuition. That would be 10% to start in FY15 and the entire 25% to kick in FY16. And there would be a 20% set aside for needs-based assistance. We went to the Board of Regents in April in Sitka and asked for permission. The vote was tabled, and it will be retaken up again at the end of this month. In Juneau. The reason we're asking for differential tuition has to do with quality. It has to do with maintaining our high-quality programs. I'll give you three quick examples. We are AACSB International Accredited, the only business school in Alaska that has both the business and accounting departments accredited. AACSB is the highest business accreditation you can have. Only 179 schools in the world have it, or just 1.4%. Every year, all of our graduating seniors have to take the Educational Testing Service Business Field Exam. 700 universities do it across the United States, and for the last 10 years, our undergraduates have averaged at the 92nd percentile, and our MBA program at the 77th percentile. And on our CPA, the CPA exam is one of the biggest things for accountants going to public accounting, and we have the highest pass rate in Alaska, have had for many years, and higher than the national rate. So we have these high-quality programs that our students are doing extremely well, and we want to maintain that. So basically, this proposal comes from financial concerns. You know, we would not go to our students and ask them to pay more if there wasn't a reason for it. The first thing I want to say is these financial pressures, as Provost Hendricks has talked about, are not ours alone. They hit every school and college at every level, and they're very serious. At the beginning or the end of last year, there was a forecasted three-year UAF debt of about $25 million. $8.5 million for this year. That debt has been reduced or eliminated by moving off-campus people on campus, eliminating those leases, doing energy savings, and so forth. So those are the easiest ones. That's the low-hanging fruit for this year. It'll get even tougher in the years after that. The specific problems for the School of Management is, first, is we have to fund the unfunded portion of all the annual salary increases. Our school is 94% salaries. It's almost everything salaries. So when we have big salary increases that we have to fund each year, it really hurts us. There's nowhere for that money to come from. From 2010 to 2013, the UAF pullbacks totaled 7.6% of our general fund, and now we're facing an annual tuition increase reduction from about 7% to around 2%. And over this six-year period, our majors and our student credit hours have increased by over 80%. So this all is like the perfect storm, the negative budget storm, which is squeezing us. But this is not uncommon, actually, across the United States. Differential tuition is very common to solve these problems for business and engineering in particular. It's not uncommon for universities now to have a table of differing tuition rates for many different programs. Differential tuition is common for faculty where schools that have high faculty salaries and that the students have high demand for those jobs and get high-paying salaries when they get out. So, for example, all Big Ten schools have it for engineering or business. 8 of 13 of the UAF peer schools have it. 13 of the 21 UA peer schools have it. Approximately 37 states now have it. North Dakota just adding it a few weeks ago for business. A good example of this differential pricing, for AACSB assigned School of Management six peer schools that are very similar to ours. One of them, Marshall University, has six different tuition prices depending on subject matter. So you just go to the tuition ones, depending on what you're in, there's different prices. Now, this pricing differential for us is only at the junior, senior, and graduate level, 300-400 in graduate courses. It does not hit students in the first 2 years or students in any of the general classes like Econ 100 that other students will be taking from us. The proposal will end up costing our students about an average of $375 per semester over a four-year period. This is about 3-4% of their total college costs. I feel the School of Management has been very responsible. We have reduced our operating budget by 40% a couple of years ago, and we operate our whole school on just $300,000 after salaries. And if you haven't done the budgets, that's like nothing. We finance all of our student scholarships and extracurricular activities, and we have a ton of both of these. We do all that off private funds. Everything's been switched over. And we are not asking the university or any of the other programs for reallocated funds to us. You know, we're not asking us to affect any other school or college or students in a negative way. Instead, what we've done is we've been very proactive about tackling this difficult issue. And that it is an issue that affects all schools and colleges. But this is the way that we feel works best for our schools. From the very beginning, faculty, staff, student leaders, they have all been involved in this from the very beginning, and their advisory boards have all worked on this. So the bottom line is that differential tuition or tuition surcharge is a responsible way for us to tackle our financial challenges. It benefits our students by being able for us to sustain the high-quality programs, and particularly it helps them get a faster time to graduation. And I'll leave you with one example of this. In our accounting program, almost all of our accountants have jobs by the end of their junior year. And the path they're on is they're in their junior year, they get an internship, they get a job offer, they go into a senior year, they get a second year of internship, and then they either have to get 150 hours if you're in public accounting, so then they get an MBA in 1 year. But these students who are offered jobs by the end of junior years have a start date, which is a specific start date, you know, 3 years later or 2 years later. They have to be able to graduate or they'll lose that job. We have to get them through in another 5 years for the undergraduate degree and the MBA. For other students that might not be on such a difficult or you know time-consuming track or a scheduled track, they're looking at jobs when they get out. They may make 50, 60, 70,000. Every semester that delays them, that is a huge delay beyond the additional $3,000 they will spend over their four-year degree. So we feel this is important for our students. And when we've explained it to our students, we've gone into many classes and we continue to have town hall meetings and stuff. After we explain it to them, we take votes and about 70% of our students support it. Virtually all of our student leaders support it. So I just wanted to give you an update of what we're doing and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dean Herman. Are there any questions for him? I have one. Mark, you know, as you know, the tuition is being held at a 2% raise. We're not able to raise tuition beyond 2%. And I'm sort of curious about two things. One is how does that affect you? And secondly, if it was not the case that it was 2%, if it was 3, 4, or no limit, how would that affect the request that you're making for differential tuition?
Well, first, I think the reduction in the tuition rate increases from 7% to 2% hurts everybody. I don't agree with those decreases. I think it's too low. If you look at our average tuition, which is just about $5,500 without the fees, we compare them to the 6 representative schools that AACSB says representatives. We're 27% lower than the average. We're at rock bottom, and I think it's the same for most UAF schools. If those tuition increases increase, we wouldn't need as much as differential tuition, but we still need it anyway. The differential tuition, that 25%, we would take in 100% of that to our school, where the other tuitions we're taking in 60% of that. So it's still a sizable chunk of money. You know, what we really need to do is have 100% of our salary increases funded, not have annual UAF pullbacks, and have a decent amount of total tuition coming in. Without that, you know, this is the way for us to do this. And again, this is very common across the United States.
Cecile?
Well, first of all, it sounds like you guys are doing great work, and your faculty and your students are to be congratulated on your success. I think philosophically, I have some thoughts about this, because fiscally, I can totally understand your argument. Philosophically, I'm wondering whether differential tuition can get us kind of on a slippery slope of the institution sort of signaling which programs are more valuable than others. And I find that troublesome if this is only determined by market value, basically. And again, I can understand, you know, the argument for your particular school. But, you know, from an institutional perspective, I do worry about that. I know there are models at other colleges where they've kind of gone in the sort of opposite direction, and I don't think we can do that here, but just to kind of as a counterpoint, where they've said every faculty member does the same jobs, they all get paid the same, there are no differences between the fields. I know we're not going to go to that system, but it's another model of looking at that rather than kind of going to the extreme of market value of a degree or a faculty member.
Our school just couldn't compete under the salary situation because we're competing against other schools. It's not about value as if one school is more valuable than the other. It is about cost. Our school costs more in faculty salaries, and our students make more. It's just a different model. You go to a supermarket, products are priced differently. It doesn't mean one's better than the other. I will say that there is another philosophical discussion on this, and that is that students that go to programs that cost less to produce and ones where they have a lower expected wage coming out are subsidizing higher cost schools by paying the same amount of tuition. So that's often cited as a philosophical argument that business students should be paying more. Higher cost program, higher expected wages. Why are other students paying the same amount and essentially subsidizing these higher end programs?
Okay, any other questions for Dean Herman? John?
Yeah, I'm curious, do you expect to see a significant decrease in enrollment because of the increased cost?
No, we don't, and I'll tell you why. We're the only school with the dual accounting and business accreditation, and it's a big thing. If you want to go to one of our six peer schools that has the exact same dual accreditation, they're similar schools to us, University of Idaho, Idaho State, you know, not like Berkeley and Stanford and stuff, the out-of-state tuition in those schools averages almost $19,000. Our tuition is, we're looking at a raise, an average raise over 4 years from about $5,500 to about $6,300. You cannot go out-of-state anymore and establish non-resident tuition. It's almost impossible. I took my son on the tour this summer of seven colleges, and it's like we're starting at UW down to Santa Barbara, and you know, have to sell our house to be able to have them go there. So it's a small amount. So we don't expect to lose a lot of students, but if we do lose some, that's fine. You know, we're happy to let the market work. But across the nation, schools are just not seeing students being lost doing this.
Anyone else? Any other questions? Chris?
Yeah, I have a question. Can you all hear me? I'm not sure if this mic is working. Can you hear me? Good. I have a question about the salary data that you're citing. Congratulations on your college having so many students with job offers while they're still enrolled in your program. That's a really excellent statistic. What I'm wondering about is about the long-term growth of the salaries. And the reason I'm wondering about this is because I have here a July 3, 2013 article in the Chronicle of Higher Education by Alexander Beecroft from the University of South Carolina. And he's putting this in a slightly different frame. He's saying that, well, for example, humanities majors typically earn from $5,000 to $15,000 less than those with undergraduate professional degrees right out of college. 15 years after graduation, that catches up. And the recipients of terminal undergraduate degrees, I'm quoting here, in the humanities are doing better. Classics majors are outperforming accounting majors. English majors are outperforming those in multimedia and web design. And history majors have caught up to nursing majors at $70,200. Undergraduate professional degrees frequently lead to relatively high starting salaries and relatively flat pay scales thereafter. So my question here is how much of the calculation about the stated higher salaries of School of Management graduates is a long-term gain as opposed to a right after graduation gain, and how much have the long-term rates been taken into account in the argument for differential tuition?
Yeah, so I haven't seen a study. Our students do really well. So we do surveys. The last 2 years, our average accounting students is making $58,000 coming out. Almost all of them are up in six digits by the third year out of there. Finance students are starting around 75. They're in the six digits very quickly. Our students, the data we're getting back, they're doing very well. I mean, we're not seeing salary compression with other majors. You know, there might be some other data being quoted out there, but ours are doing good. And you know, of course, the average between the average and medium salaries are difficult too. We have you know, bank presidents and all that sort of stuff in the salary mix, but no, I don't see that with our students.
Okay, any other questions for Dean Herman? We probably should wrap this up pretty soon. Okay, thank you, Mark, appreciate it.
Thank you, Dave.
Dean, Chancellor Brian Rogers is with us, and so we'll go ahead and give him an opportunity to give his remarks.
Well, thanks, and I apologize for being late. I was at introducing a luncheon speaker, and it's hard to walk out in the middle of this presentation. I want to welcome everybody back for the new semester. We're actually seeing a surprise in early numbers yet, but a slight gain in enrollment in a year that we expected not to see that. The numbers that are being reported system-wide, though, don't reflect that. And I wanted to just let people know that we're actually doing a little bit better than the numbers show. The reason is that we're starting classes later this year than in prior years. And all of the comparisons essentially look at same date to same date of registration. Well, because we're starting later, when we re-ran the numbers and looked at the last ones were last Monday, the Monday that we start classes versus the Monday that we start classes, we're actually up about a little over 3% in students headcount and just a little over 1% in student credit hours. So that's good news and really reflects, I think, some confidence in this university. I won't report on how the other two are doing, but it looks good to see how well we're doing. I also want to, it's been really neat, we had the welcome for new faculty, and over the last year, 50 new faculty at UAF. And clearly that, I think that's the highest number I've seen since I've been chancellor. It really reflects, you know, the loss of some good people, but also a nice opportunity to welcome new people into the UAF community at our community campuses and at UAF Fairbanks campus as well. I appreciated coming in during the discussion of differential tuition. There are deep philosophical issues, there are deep economic issues to consider, and I would hope that the Faculty Senate will engage in that discussion. My own view is that a differential is appropriate for when there are really three conditions: high cost, high demand, and high wage. And School of Management does fit that one. I think the general mood at the Board of Regents and system-wide really reflects the national mood that tuition has been escalating too rapidly. As Mark pointed out, UAS is among the lower, among our peers, at least for baccalaureate institutions. We're among the higher at the community college level. Alaska is very high for community college and really reflects our, is a challenge of our organization being multi-mission. But I think that pressure is likely to keep tuition increases below what some of us would like to see outside of considering such things as differential tuition. So on the revenue side, our opportunity to make it up will have to be by attracting more students, and particularly at the upper division level. Current year's budget is a tight one. We started the year a little over $8 million short, and through management of taking some one-time savings, we're managing non-faculty vacancies, really trying to force them to stay open longer than we normally would have. Space management, energy conservation, and some vertical cuts, we expect to come out even by the end of the year, but it is a tight budget year. And given the tenor at the state of Alaska on the revenue side, with less in state revenues for the coming year, I would expect our budget request will not be, or the budget as approved won't see really significant gains. We have submitted UAS requests to the system office. We haven't yet seen what's going to go forward to the Board of Regents. There's one item in there that actually I will highlight because it's triggered by this last discussion. UAF has asked for incremental funds for faculty salaries above whatever the negotiated amount would be. This will actually have to be a negotiation with UNAC coming forward. But our sense is that particularly in the research-intensive areas, we're falling further behind, that the annual increases have not kept up, and so that we're now below where we should be relative to our market. And again, that reflects what has been the primary approach of the University of Alaska system for most of the last two decades, which is really a market comparison, trying to hit at least 90% of the median of peer institutions. Personally, I think 90% is kind of a low number to shoot for, but even at that, we're below where we need to be to attract and more importantly, to retain our high-quality talent. We haven't gone in for an extra market boost for faculty above whatever the annual cost of living has for almost two decades. And the last time I can remember was about 1990-91, and it took us two and a half years to really sell it in the legislature. We were ultimately successful in doing that, and I'm hopeful that both through the collective bargaining process and then through the legislative process we'll be successful in getting that. But success comes comes at a price. As noted earlier, the legislature only funds 50% of our compensation increases, and so we'll have to address internally the other 50% on that. We have a small amount in for fixed cost increases in our budget request, and one of the smallest new program requests that I can remember in 30 years of dealing with the university budget, under 2%. Growth, and I expect that to be cut even further. So pretty much flat would be better than some would expect. On the capital side, a pretty big lift in our capital budget. We have the completion of the engineering building and the request for the replacement for the heat and power plant. The first of those is a $33 million request. The second, a $200 million request to the legislature that would be augmented by $45 million of borrowing that UAF would do based on fuel cost savings. So the biggest capital budget request in memory there. In addition, in our capital budget, we've requested some academic equipment replacement and a series of five capital research initiatives. Last year, we had three that went forward, one and a half that were funded. I'm hopeful on the capital research side we can get some going into the future. Finally, I just want to thank everyone who's been around over the summer for putting up with the construction challenges. There were, I know for some faculty who were here over the summer, the vibration, the disruption, the getting around campus was a challenge. I certainly felt it, not knowing some days if I could actually drive off campus from my house. But I think what we're going to see out the other end really will make a difference. With Murray open, with the backfill for people who moved out of Bunnell, and now for people who moved out of Eielson, we're getting some savings out of that. The completion of the Smart Classrooms project that we initiated 2 years ago and utility upgrades should make a significant difference for the campus long term. And with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions that anyone might have.
Thank you, Chancellor Rogers. Any questions for him?
Hello. Yeah. So I just wanted to clarify this thing. Why is the why Alaska Senate only or is only supporting 50% of the faculty increase?
The Legislative Finance Division, the Legislative Finance Committees take the position that because if we look at the university budget as a whole, roughly 42% of the budget is state-funded, that therefore 50% is generous to us, that they're funding with the state, and we should make it up with our other revenue sources. Our challenge, of course, is that our other revenue sources are not increasing to cover those costs. But that's the sort of philosophical basis for that position, is that so much of our and in fact, some of our costs are covered. For those faculty members and staff who are charging to federal grants and contracts, the pay raise money does, in fact, charge to those federal grants and contracts. So from a legislative standpoint, that looks good. From our standpoint, what it means is that you have fewer months of salary left in your grant when the rates go up. And so it's not that we're getting new money because the salaries have gone up, but we have a stronger draw on those. Our indirect cost recovery not going up, our many of our other sources just not going up. But that there is an arguable reason behind their 50% position.
I mean, we are going and asking them for 50% is my question. Or are they suggesting us that we should only get 50% was my
opinion. They have told us not to ask for more than
50%. More than 50%, okay. And the engineering building, as far as I know, is a separate budgetary item rather than the university budget, correct?
Capital budget items are separate appropriations and can only be spent for the purpose for which the legislature appropriates. And they actually have different chairs and different committees that deal with our operating budget and deal with our capital budget. We've blended the line a little bit with our requests for research projects in the capital budget. It used to be we asked for all of them as operating items and never got any. Now by actually asking for some, let me correct that, we seldom receive those in the operating budget. Occasionally we have. But by asking for discrete projects in the capital budget, we've opened up a new source of revenue for the research community.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Okay. What I propose we do is do one item of old business, and then we'll have our break. This bit of old business is something that occurred at the began at our very, well, it's actually our very first Senate meeting. Or was it our very last? Anyway, it was the very last one last year. And we received a complaint concerning two issues of the student newspaper, the Sun Star. And as a result of those complaints, we made a motion for the administrative committee to basically deal with it as best we could. And I want to report back to you the results of our efforts over the summer to deal with that. So just brief recap of what we're talking about. The complaints were concerning first the April Fool's edition of the Sun Star, which is actually called the Fun Star. And in last April's edition, there was an article that focused on a supposed proposal to build a vagina-shaped building, words that I never thought I would say from this microphone. And there were some pictures in there, one of which was a copyright violation from a movie, and a couple of spoof quotes and so forth. The second issue was an actual serious issue from the Sun Star concerning a Facebook page, a public Facebook page, titled UAF Confessions. And the article in question on the Sun Star was a fairly serious look at what was happening on that very public Facebook page, including some screenshots with some comments with people identified. And one of the people that was identified was a graduate student, a female graduate student, in a fairly demeaning way. They essentially asked if they like if you slept with this student. We met as an administrative committee back in May to learn as much as we could about these issues. We met with Mae Marsh, the chair or the head of Equal Employment and Diversity, and I messed up that title. We met with Don Foley, and we met with Robin, the faculty advisor for the Sun Star, whose name I was just completely blanking. I'm sorry, Robin, if you're here. And what you can see on the first two attachments of the agenda is essentially the result of that. The first is the summary of that meeting that we held and what exactly occurred at that meeting. The second is the what we committed to as a result of that meeting, which was essentially contacting the editorial board of the Sun Star through Robin in order to make the requests that we had to make. And those requests were to the picture had already been deleted from the Sun Star website because it was a copyright violation, so they got whether they got a cease and takedown letter or they just realized that they were in violation, I'm not sure. But anyway, that picture went away. We asked them to remove a quote that was attributed to the Women's Center director, Kate Sunwood. We further asked them to redact the names of people that were associated with comments in the UAF Confessions piece. And I just realized there's an important bit of information there. The graduate student that was identified during this meeting, we saw a written request from that graduate student asking that her name be included. Okay, so I want to make sure that that's emphasized. This was at her request, it turned out, that she wanted her name to be included in the piece. She did not. Her reasoning was that she did not want to essentially cower in the face of bullying. So we did not make a request concerning that, but we did make a request that people who had posted offensive comments, that those people not be identified. So far from the Sun Star, I've received a couple of verbal statements, waiting for written ones that we requested. I'm hopeful that they may even be in my inbox today. I haven't checked my email yet today. So, but essentially what they were was, number one, they said that that the appropriate way for them was to, the appropriate step for them to take was to more clearly identify the Funstar article about the vagina-shaped building, the new proposed one, as a spoof, and that it, to make it more clear that the supposed quote from Kate Sunwood would be clearly not a real quote. Otherwise, they did not want to change that article. The second set of requests was concerning the UAF Confessions article. They rejected our request to redact the names, and their line of reasoning was that this Facebook page was very public. Anyone can go to it, anyone can see any of the comments, and they saw little utility in not displaying names that were already on display on the UAF Confessions webpage. That's the communication that I've received so far from the Funstar editorial board.
Can I add just one piece? But the Funstar article, a similar version of that has, from what we understand, appeared in previous editions of the Funstar, except that the building was shaped as a penis as opposed to a vagina. And so, so this was not the first time this idea had been rolled out in the Funstar edition.
And if you read the thank you. And if you read the memo that Cecile and I and the, wrote on behalf of the administrative committee, what we tried to emphasize was not that we were trying to assert some sort of authority over the Funstar, which we don't have, and we weren't trying to compromise in any way the First Amendment liberties of the Funstar to print what it sees fit. What we attempted to do was to appeal to some higher journalistic standard than what we saw as being some decisions that were in poor taste. But that's about as far as we thought was our was appropriate for us to take it. Now, two other things that are germane to this. One is that that UAF Confessions webpage, Facebook page, I should say, last time I checked, which was a few days ago, still exists. We've asked Don Foley to ask that, that that name be changed, since that could arguably be seen as an infringement on the UAF branding. It's a little bit ticklish because there are other universities with the acronym UAF out there, so it's not entirely convincing that if they're not showing our logo, whether that's really a branding issue.
No,
so we'll have to see how that goes.
No,
I know. Yeah, I know. And the second thing is that there is an ongoing, and hence I can't report on it, investigation that Mae Marsh's office is working on and elsewhere. The results of that are still unavailable, and to the extent that they can be available when it's all done, we'll report back. Okay. Are there any questions? Debu?
Just a comment. Thank you very much for doing this.
You're welcome. A lot of people worked pretty hard on trying to make sure that we carefully navigated some fairly tricky waters with respect to that. And anyway, thank you. What I propose is we take our how long is this break supposed to be, Jane? Let's take a 5-minute break. And come back here at 2:10. Thanks. Okay, welcome back. Our first item of new business is a reaffirmation of a resolution supporting of allowing candidates for promotion, tenure, or comprehensive review to opt for open meetings, which is submitted by the Administrative Committee, which is attachment 192/3. The Senate has, for the last several years, encouraged each of the units on campus through this resolution to hold open meetings for consideration of faculty files for promotion, tenure, and promotion tenure. Yes, so I submit this for discussion.
Should we move on the resolution first? Okay.
If you we can discuss. I assume that the motion to adopt the motion is on the floor.
Oh, okay.
Move to adopt. Yep. I should probably get out Robert's Rules of Order to make sure I'm not screwing it up too badly. So let's consider discussion open for this resolution. And please note the difference between a resolution and a motion. A resolution is essentially the Senate registering its opinion, its voice. Okay, it has nothing binding to it. It's simply the sense of the Senate. A motion typically is exercising the Senate's authority, either over its own bylaws or over some other aspect of university life over which it has shared governance responsibilities. This is a resolution. Are there any objections to adoption of this resolution? Seeing none, resolution is passed unanimously. Second item of new business. Flip back and forth. This requires a little bit of explanation. This and the next motion are really the result of a self-inflicted wound last year. For a long time, there was a permanent committee of the Faculty Senate called the Faculty Appeals and Oversight Committee. And it had a number of responsibilities, but really they weren't that many that we thought that a whole committee was needed for. And so last year, the Senate voted to get rid of the Faculty Appeals and Oversight Committee and essentially fold all of its duties into the Faculty Senate Administrative Committee, that is the Committee of Committee Chairs. Over the summer, Cecile, I think it was either you, pointed out that that's all well and good until about March. And in March, something really bad happens, which is that throughout the year, a number of administrator reviews is undertaken. And this is a process that has been underway, that has been occurring at UAF since about 2000, and with faculty involvement. And the committees that are responsible for evaluating administrative performances reported in March to the Faculty Appeals and Oversight Committee. And if we leave it the way it currently is, then all of those administrative review committees would report to the Faculty Senate Administrative Committee, which we just didn't see how we would be able to deal with that in addition to our other duties as the Administrative Committee. So we thought about this and decided that the best course of action would be to put together a new permanent committee of the Faculty Senate that would essentially be another committee of committee chairs. And this would be a committee consisting of the chairs of the various ad hoc committees that are undertaking reviews of administrators. Okay, so this would essentially serve two roles. It would, number one, serve the role of being the committee to which those ad hoc committees would report the results of their evaluations of administrator performance. And at the same time, as it goes to the provost or to the other administrator, the cognizant administrator, supervising the person being evaluated. It would also act as something of a mechanism to enable and encourage the various committees to communicate with one another as they go through the process during the year, ensuring that some semblance of best practices is going on, and there's sharing of ideas and procedures and so forth as we go along. So that was our bright idea. And these two motions essentially are necessary in order to enable it. One is to establish the permanent committee and how it would be constituted. And the second is that we have an existing set of guidelines for how administrator reviews are to be undertaken, and we needed to revise those procedures in order to take advantage of this new committee. So that's what these two motions are about. These are motions that were drafted largely by Cecile and myself with approval of the administrative committee. We're sort of hoping that they're ready for prime time, so I submit it to you for your questions. Yes.
Sorry, I may not have understood something that you said. I'm a little bit confused about this. But you're saying that during the year, the administrators are reviewed by various ad hoc committees, right?
That's correct.
And that the chairs of these committees would then make up another level of review through this thing. And so my question is, isn't that a little bit inbred? Don't you want another level at which people who have not already reviewed these administrators are going to review their work?
That's a fair point. Our thought was that we would have a Faculty Senate representative actually chair that committee. So there would be somebody who is not currently involved with any of the administrative reviews on that committee and actually heading up that committee.
And one point of clarification. The review that happens is not a review of the performance of the administrator, but a review of the process that was used.
To do the review,
exactly. So, so even though the ad hoc committee chairs may have shared some information or gotten input from each other, there are certain requirements for how these reviews need to happen. There are certain elements that need to be part of those reviews that are written out in the policy about reviews. So the main function is to make sure that those policies are followed.
It sounds like that review should be happening before the review. Am I missing something? Would that not make more sense? Because if you reviewed it and found that the policies and procedures were not correct, are they then going to go back and do the review again?
Well, the policies and procedures are pretty well set out. What we have to do is to make sure that at the tail end of it, all of the stuff they were supposed to do got done and was done appropriately.
Okay.
So that does exist as the second motion. So these two are sort of tied together.
Okay.
Well, it occurs to me that this argument might be leveled towards any review process, and that we can run the risk of infinite regress there, of doing reviews after reviews of reviews of reviews. I don't quite understand why this particular one require this motion.
We need a mechanism by which at the end of each ad hoc committee's review process that the results of that review are essentially reported, and including an evaluation of the procedures. So that was the duty of the Faculty Appeals and Oversight Committee, which we used to have and no longer have. So this committee essentially is to take on that particular duty. It's to replace a committee that used to exist with a slightly more well-defined committee.
Okay.
So we're really not, the idea here really isn't to change much, it's to avoid changing. This is to kind of keep the procedures largely the same as they were.
So the committee will have the authority to make whoever did the original review go back and correct it if there was problems with it? Or no?
I suppose so, but my hope would be that along the way, problems would be coming up in that meeting, in meetings of those chairs.
Is the meeting regularly?
Yeah.
Okay.
And how often they meet, they can determine, you know, so this doesn't have to be like, you know, once a week or even every other week kind of thing. They can meet however often they need, as long as there's sort of, you know, the sort of understanding that there's this quality control process. But basically at the end of the review cycle.
Glenn.
Just to review that a little more closely, what I'm grasping at is that the the benefit of having done it is captured and institutionalized and used and applied and make the process better. How if we move to this procedure, you've got ad hoc chairs of the administrative review, then you'll probably have a different set of individuals involved the next time, right?
Yes, they would.
Okay, so it seems to me that the focus should be on applying the lessons, capturing them and applying them and training whomever it is that is involved in the relevant process the next time around. So this idea of timing of it is, I think, worth considering.
Yeah, if I understand your point correctly, one of the things that we've sort of chewed on over the course of the summer was how to, in effect, have some institutional memory, that there's some learning that goes on longitudinally through this. I've submitted a request to legal counsel here at UAF about what kinds of information we can potentially retain from one review cycle to the next so that the next committee can have a little bit of a head start, not the particulars, for example, hopefully not the issues of personnel confidentiality. We don't want to run afoul of that, but to be able to retain that information and have it available for the next go-round. So we've been thinking about that. We haven't received yet, I've gotten questions, but I haven't received any answers yet from legal counsel about that. Debu?
I have two things to ask. One is, why can't we just once again revive the Faculty Appeals and Oversight Committee? Because it will serve a lot of purpose for non-CBA-related faculty appeals, okay? And that's becoming critical every day because there are issues, faculty issues, that CBA doesn't cover and can be covered by faculty senate. That's one. Second thing is, what is the, this is a question, what is the impact of these reviews is the big question. I mean, suppose somebody gets a glowing review, that's fine. But if somebody gets a non-glowing review, an administrator, what's the impact is what I don't know yet.
I understand the question in the sense that that what assurances do we have? I'm debating whether I should turn that question a little bit over to the provost if she wouldn't object, and the chancellor, right?
Yeah, the chancellor may wish to speak to this. For obvious reasons, can't name names here, but the input that I receive from the evaluation committees is incorporated into a frank evaluation of the administrator's performance. If the assessment is very negative, the administrator may not be retained. That's happened a few times. I think a number of you can remember the instances. But most of the time, the evaluation is geared toward helping the administrator to rectify the weaknesses that are identified in the assessment.
The other thing I would add is, in my answer to Glenn Judet's question, one of the values that I see in having some longitudinal memory, in other words, retaining the actual committee reports from one period to the next, give us the possibility of, in a sort of an analogous fashion to how we submit our own files, we're required to have evaluation. So this would be a previous committee evaluation that the next committee would be able to access and then tailor the current evaluation around. So that would be the hope. John?
Yeah, another comment is it might be a good idea. We've had, Knut was worried about this iteration or what happens at the end of a particular review. You can kind of get around a lot of that if you have your committee chairs who form this new committee meet a little more often rather than just at the end. If they're meeting during the process, they can touch bases, and you can sort of do some correction along the way. How did you do this survey? Or, adjust these things so we can avoid these problems at the end.
That was largely our thinking, was to have this be a mechanism that's useful throughout the academic year, not just in March.
Right. And we'll have a folder somewhere with questions and surveys, whatever, that were used before that the committee can use, hopefully with notation saying this question didn't get us much, or, you know, or we should have asked it this way, or whatever. So there's some information about what is useful and what isn't.
Ubiquitous warning that no matter what question you ask, you will get a several paragraph answer about parts.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Any other Debu?
Yeah, the first question was can we consider or reconsider reviving the Faculty Appeals and Oversight Committee?
So that.
And what's the procedure?
Well, you know, the procedure would be that we would refer to appropriate committee and come up with a resolution to do that. It would bother me a great deal to just simply revive something that we found wanting before. I would much prefer to think deliberately about what is needed and then try to put together the best, you know, committee that would be appropriate to that. So last year's Senate found the existing Faculty Appeals and Oversight Committee to be wanting. That is, it was not really serving, we thought, a useful role, forgetting about March.
Have there been any appeals?
Very few, is my understanding.
Yeah, but we can certainly make an attempt to let
the
faculty. Yeah.
And keep in mind, what we thought was not that these duties that the Faculty Appeals and Oversight Committee, you know, didn't exist so much as we thought that the Administrative Committee could do those. So if you're, it may be that what you're essentially saying is that maybe the Administrative Committee might not be quite correct for that. My suggestion, I guess, would be to see how it goes this year and see whether or not the Administrative Committee can deal with those appropriately. We think they can, but one problem that we've identified that we don't think we can, is the issue of hearing back from all the ad hoc committees. And we propose this as a mechanism that would have the value added of essentially keeping communication lines open among the various committees who are undertaking these evaluations. Yeah.
So if this is all untried and it's not clear yet whether the Administrative Committee can take over all the functions of the Appeals Committee, then do we have to approve a motion that might be sort of permanent until it's repealed, rather than, say, have something to try out for this year?
I'm not exactly sure what you're saying. The decision to get rid of the Faculty Appeals and Oversight Committee and move all of their responsibility to the Administrative Committee, that was done last year. So that's the way it was worked last year?
I understand that, but you just said that you need to find out whether or not it's actually doable. Right,
and that happened last year. The administrative,
it was doable.
Not the part where we heard from the. I'm not exactly sure what happened to the administrative reviews last year. There were some that. Okay, go ahead and.
Well, my office was responsible for one, so last year was a relatively light year. I think what contributes to the urgency of this request is that we're anticipating at least four reviews through several offices this year, and maybe five, and that will be a much higher workload for the committee. Something that Dave hasn't mentioned, which is not strictly about the establishing this committee, but is about a revision to procedures that is associated with it, is that one of the challenges in constituting so many review committees is that the current rules call for there to be two Senate members on each committee. The restructuring would allow for having only one Senate member on each committee, and it would place far fewer demands on the Senate membership for participating in these committees. And I think that's something to consider, because if you look around you, having to have 10 senators in addition to perhaps other committee service serving on these administrative review committees is a big demand of the Senate time.
Yeah, thanks, Susan. I think that was definitely an important point. And even with Debu's suggestion for reviving the old committee, you know, that would still require several Senate members, whereas now there is one who chairs the new committee and then others, you know, and then one more on each of the ad hoc committees, but it's still overall probably less demand on the Senate, and we're having a hard time really populating the committees as is, so.
Okay. So a follow-up comment.
And also, let me just try, because I'm I try to be a structured thinker, or which means I tend not to be. But the first motion that we're considering is actually the establishment of the committee. What I would prefer to do is to have the discussion focus on should we have this committee, and then the second motion is concerning changing the procedures in order to have this committee play its role. Okay, so there's two motions. So right now I'd like the discussion to focus on the existence of this committee.
And my follow-up comment is on the B only, okay, not on the C. Am I allowed to speak?
I'm not sure what you mean by B or C. Yeah.
New business B.
Yes, B, yes, yes, B. Thank you. Yes,
okay,
B, yes.
So what I see you are suggesting, Cecile, is that we lose control over all this, you know, I mean, all this review and everything. We have one senator that's going there, and we don't want to have any further control by involving more senators, which I think is the senators are representative of their, you know, their unit. And so they bring value. You know, one senator probably represents, I don't know how many faculty, 30, I believe, isn't that right? So they bring value. And when we are reviewing, we have a committee that reviews administrators, it's a serious business. Just like any faculty being reviewed by peers or administrators is a serious business. Now we are saying, okay, no, let's not be so serious. We just have a senator because we have a lot of work, and we just give it away. And that's what I'm getting as a feeling, but correct me, please, if I'm wrong.
I believe mostly what you're speaking to is actually C, not B.
No, B.
Because the committee is constituted of the chairs of the various committees, and it's not. It's true that that's not necessarily going to be a bunch of senators.
Right.
But it could be.
There still needs to be one senator on each ad hoc committee, plus senator to chair.
So that's I see as a faculty appeals and oversight committee type, you know, arrangement. So what's wrong in reviving? You know, I'm not saying today. Okay, let's think about it, you know, and maybe revive it, which will help both faculty and administrators in the process. What I see is that faculty probably are not getting the support that that should be that they could have gotten, you know, I'm not using the wrong English here, but by this faculty appeals committee, okay? And when they come to, let us say, UNAC or UAFT, the CBS don't cover a few.
Deb, I'm going to cut you off.
Yeah.
We're not talking about the faculty appeals and oversight committee. That's another conversation.
Right, I understand. Okay, I'm just kind of blending this together.
Right. Okay, are there any other comments? Discussion items or discussion points you'd like to make. Would somebody like to make a move to adopt this motion?
So moved.
Okay.
And seconded.
Okay. Let the record reflect that. Thank you. All right. Since this is a fairly serious thing, we're going to ask for a vote. So all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Say nay.
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 Perhaps we should do a show of hands just to be on the safe side. All right, can I get a show of hands? Those in favor of the motion, please raise your hand. And remote. Okay, 20. Okay, and remotely.
Raise your hand.
Folks who are remote, I guess you're all opposed. All right, how about opposed? Raise your hand, please. Okay, motion carries. Moving on to the C motion. The C motion is concerning revising the administrator review guidelines so that we have a procedure that reflects the existence of this new committee, as well as addresses some of the concerns that the provost indicated earlier with respect to finding people to serve on the committee. Okay. You'll notice that the additions are in bold to the evaluation process, and deletions are in square brackets. Possibly the item that the provost brought up earlier about going to one, specifying one faculty senate representative, at least one faculty representative for each ad hoc committee, represents something of a substantial change. But the reason for that is exactly what the provost mentioned, is that it becomes difficult to reuse senators and find so many to populate these committees. So we think that the our sense was that the principal role that the senators, having senators there would be to alert to us to any problems that might be occurring on those committees. And having one versus two, we didn't see that as particularly damaging to that role. Okay. Any questions, comments, discussion points? Yes.
Well, could there be something in there that this could be made a tenured faculty? You know, I for myself, not tenured, depending on the review, not overly. It might be awkward.
Oh boy, here we go. That gets a little bit of a can of worms, I think, if we specify that here. I mean, I think I understand what you're after, but since we have term faculty who are not necessarily tenured, I wouldn't necessarily want to exclude them, for example, from serving on this. Provost Hendricks?
I can say it's always my practice to choose tenured faculty where that's appropriate and good people are available. There would be occasions, the director of the Cooperative Extension Service or the director of an institute that had almost exclusively research faculty like IARC, where in order to get participation from the unit, one might not be able to choose tenured faculty. Now, there are tenured faculty in cooperative extension, but about 50% of their total faculty now are term. Dave's point about excluding people from representation is I think, a good one. But there's certainly a preference in my practice for tenured faculty where that's appropriate.
Other comments? Is it just too warm in here?
Can we move for adoption?
Okay. Do I have a second?
Second.
Okay. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Say nay. Okay. The motion is unanimously adopted. We now move to discussion items. The first item of discussion is we're going to receive a report from Jonathan Rosenberg, who is chairing the General Education Revitalization Committee, which is a subcommittee of the Curricular Affairs Committee. And I'm very grateful, speaking personally, that Jonathan has agreed to continue on in that capacity this fall. So thank you, Jonathan, for that and for coming today.
Thank you. I don't know if I have enough to actually present to merit my own name tag, but at any rate, this is carryover from from the last session of last spring semester, where those of you who were there at the time got, I guess, what could best be called an executive summary of the report that you have in front of you now. So this, with the exception of one bit of new information, which I'll say something about in a moment, largely amplifies on that. Just a few things to point out. What we have here is the first attempt by GERC and five working groups that acted as breakout groups of GERC to operationalize the new learning outcomes by creating this new set of attributes, which we think speak to those outcomes, and suggesting a distribution of coursework that not specific classes, and that's an important and conscious omission on the part of GERC at this point, but a kind of menu of coursework more generally to try and satisfy these learning outcomes. All of this with an eye towards something that's eluded the core curriculum, and that's accessibility of the entire program, not just in individual classes or subsections of the program. And this has been a bit of a challenge. I mentioned this in the document you have before you, but I think this bears a little bit of reinforcing. We are working, or GERC has been working, within the parameters established by the existing general education requirements as laid out by the Board of Regents in policy and in regulation. And the regulation, which stipulates that certain numbers of courses need to be taken in certain disciplinary areas, is the one that is the aspect that's really the most challenging, plus the stipulation that most of the classes that satisfy those disciplinary general education requirements are essentially lower division survey courses. There are dueling philosophies here. And as I say in the document, different but not necessarily incompatible. The more traditional general education approach that is represented by Board of Regents policy and regulations at this point, and the more holistic, integrative, and to a certain extent applied approach that come from the LEAP learning outcomes that inform the work of GERC even before I got there. So we've done our best to try and find some areas of compatibility. This document's already been reviewed by the administrative committee in a meeting a couple of weeks ago and received some very useful and valuable feedback. This may anticipate some of your questions, but let me just mention, because we have not, GERC has not yet met, so there hasn't been a rewriting of this since the meeting with the admin committee, but one point made was, in a couple of different ways, was to clarify the C, this new communication attribute. Would it be a replacement for the O and W's? And that has been GERC's thinking for the most part, that it would. A related question was raised that would a course, in order to qualify for this new C attribute, if it's easier to think of attributes as designators, that's fine too, because in a way that's what we're talking about. We just tried to stay away from that word for a variety of reasons. Would the C courses, would any course that qualify for C need to encompass oral, written, and visual communication? That's a conversation we have to have within GERC and among the faculty at large. I would probably tend to say no, but that's just my personal opinion at this point. And the other recommendation that we got, at least in writing, was that the diversity attribute should be more specific, more explicit about including gender and sexual identity as elements of diversity that would qualify, of course, for that attribute. All friendly comments and all ones that I think GERC will receive well and be able to work with fairly easily. There was also a question about the methods and the process for assigning these attributes eventually. We had not gotten very far in that conversation with GERC. We're kind of working on the informal assumption that there would be some sort of process similar to core review at this point, where there would be committees, a committee and or subcommittees perhaps for the different attributes, where proposals would be submitted. They would be reviewed once we have, you know, everything really sort of fleshed out, including the rubrics for the courses, and decide which courses would qualify. The new bit of information in here is in appendix, which is it, appendix number 2, General Education Learning Outcomes Committee, or GELO. Some of the representatives of GERC, as well as of CAC, Reiner was there in January, attended a meeting in Anchorage about general education reform on a system-wide basis. Certainly UAF is much further along in the process than any of the other, I'm not supposed to say MAUs anymore, am I?
Universities,
okay, good, than any other universities. But both UAA and UAS have been talking about it and have their contributions to make. And in fact, the approach that UAA was taking was to really kind of revisit, rethink, and possibly seek change in the Board of Regents regulations. And given that UAF was so much further along and that this meeting in January was actually convened by or facilitated by people from AACNU, everyone got the education, if not indoctrination, into the LEAP outcomes. And there seems to be a fairly common agreement among the three universities that this is a useful set of guidelines. So what we've done so far, the second meeting, which was just held virtually this morning, is largely to wordsmith what the UAF Faculty Senate passed, clean it up a little bit, make it a little more universal, with the idea that what we're looking for on a system-wide basis is to retain and possibly even facilitate better the region's requirements for full transferability of general education requirements among the three universities of the system, and also to, as we have been doing in GERC, to allow more flexibility in the selection of classes that students choose to fulfill whatever version of the general education requirements we finally wind up with, but also preserve the uniqueness of the different campuses so that we have some sort of common standards, but not ones that will lock each university into areas where they may not be interested in going any further than they are, or don't necessarily have the resources, especially in the case of UAS with the smaller faculty and student body, to be able to service effectively so students can graduate in a timely manner. And then finally, accessibility. And that's probably what makes the LEAP, the LEAP outcomes or our variation on the LEAP outcomes particularly attractive, is currently there really doesn't seem to be a way to assess the core curriculum as a whole, to really assess it in terms not just of how students do in particular areas or particular classes, but what it does for their, to coin a phrase, general education, and how it integrates with the more specialized knowledge they're getting from their majors and their minors and certificates. So that's what GELO, the system-wide committee, is working on now. Representation on GELO is faculty, three members from each of the universities, and all of, at a later stage, registrars as well, to help us with a lot of the technical issues and problems that we're bound to create as we go along. So where we are in the process now is we have this report on what we've found, what we were proposing so far, and this we conceive of as part of an ongoing iterative process that once the Faculty Senate considers it, slices it, and dices it, we will turn into an actual proposal that we will then put before the faculty for public consultation and input.
Let me just make sure I understood you correctly. You're asking everybody here to have at it and feed that back to you? Offline, I don't mean right now, but...
That sounds like I'm...
okay, I didn't mean to put words in your mouth. I thought that's what I kind of...
Yeah, I mean, ideally, that's what I'd hope to do.
I just want to add one other thing that you kind of hinted at, Jonathan, which is that one of the advantages to this, he says GLO, I say JELO, the statewide effort, is that if three faculty senates all go to the Board of Regents and the university president and say, you know, these university regulations are really in the way as they're currently worded, and we'd like to see some changes in the university regulations that would allow us to adopt a much more flexible and powerful set of general education requirements and then a curriculum. I think that would have a lot more weight at that level than, say, just the one faculty senate would. So I see some real advantage to working with the other two universities on this.
Right.
Any questions for Jonathan? Okay, I'm going to...
I actually have a question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So in the document, it talks about the civic engagement. Mm-hmm. Is that going to be mandatory for every student? Is that... It's hard to tell from the document.
Yeah. The answer is that remains to be seen. What Kirk was thinking was yes, but maybe not in the way you might be thinking. And in fact, this very...
I'm not against it. As a person who volunteers a lot of time outside of the university, I think it's great for people to do it. The problem is if you make every single person do it as a branding thing, you might not want to have some sullen 18-year-olds
yes, exactly.
out there representing UAF in the community because they're upset about having to do this.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it would be better if this was an option, kind of like the 6-1-5 of something else is the, like, humanities and whatever the other thing is. If people want to do that, awesome. If they don't, that's good, too, because if they don't want to do it, you don't want that out there as a university thing. You know, if somebody who's unhappy with that, that can really put a negative light on the university as a whole. That would be my comment.
Yeah, no, I can't disagree with that at all. And that discussion has been had, and it came up at the GLO meeting this morning as well, because Anchorage and UAS have been thinking about it as well. We actually approach, if you read carefully that outcome or requirement, it doesn't specify, and we wrote it this way on purpose, that a student actually has to act to be placed in a particular situation in the community. It could be done in a more academic way. It doesn't necessarily. And the other side of the coin that we really emphasized was it may be impractical for a lot of students who work full-time, family obligations, and all the rest. Plus, given the size of our student body relative to the size of our home community, we'll overrun all of the social service agencies, government offices, and wherever else people might be. So we want other opportunities, whether they be on campus or they be of a more academic nature. The idea being just some way preparing students for more informed and engaged citizenship.
Okay, any other questions for him quickly? Because I see on the clock that we have 1 minute to get through more than 1 minute worth of stuff. So much for that idea of moving along briskly.
Question over here.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah,
Chris.
Question. Has the committee settled on the number of total credits that will be required for GERC, or is that still in progress?
Well, the poll we did at the beginning of last year seemed to indicate that 36 was sort of the favored number, with very, very strong sentiment for trying to get it in below the current 39 minimum for the core, but based on the assumption that the Regents minimum of 34 would remain in place. So 36 is, as with everything else in here, is not set in stone, but that's kind of what we were working on.
Great, thanks.
Any other? No, good, okay, thank you. I'm going to delay talking about the Status of Learning Management System project, except for saying one thing. If you're worried that we're sort of going to impose a new learning management system on anybody, that's not going to happen. That was the main thing I was going to say anyway. Do staff counsel, Brad, do you want to say anything?
Sure.
Fairly quickly.
Be relatively brief here. I wanted to say that staff counsel is looking forward to
being more involved with faculty and students. And in that vein, I hope you'll see me or the Vice President, Ashley Monroe, here at your meetings regularly. At the system-wide level, there is the System Governance Council, which consists of faculty, staff, and student reps from all of the governance groups. And those meetings have been called for the next year, and so I'm hoping that the three governance groups can be more engaged that way. There's also locally, at, that is UAF, the Governance Coordinating Committee, which consists of representatives from Faculty Senate, Staff Council, and ASUAF. And I think it would be a good idea possibly to call those meetings. They're supposed to be held two a semester, but I suspect that they have either not been held at all or have been held over email. And that's mostly what I had to say. You know, there are things that we're looking forward at for the new semester. You know, some of the things will be possibly staff specific, but I think there'll be lots of things where having that cross perspective will be very valuable. So that's what I wanted to bring today.
Thank you, Brad. And just to highlight that, at the Faculty Alliance meeting, we started thinking about, you know, what's the use of these system governance councils. And we started thinking about just getting rid of them. And then we ran through our items, and it turned out there were two or three that were clearly candidates for things that the coordinating councils ought to be involved with. So I look forward to doing that with you.
Yeah. I just quickly off the top of my head, the tuition waiver was something that got passed back to system governance. Using sick leave donation for maternity leave was something that came from Faculty Senate back in 2008 that got passed to Staff Council that went up to Staff Alliance. I think it eventually died, but, you know, that was something that was cross-platform. The possibility of smoke-free campus is definitely something that seems crossed. So I think there are definitely issues there that we'd all be concerned with.
All right. Thank you, Brad.
Thank you.
Do we have any report from ASUAF, Associated Students of University of Alaska Fairbanks? And United Academics? We don't have. How about UAFT, Jane?
I just wanted to say that Joint Healthcare Committee, what's it called? Joint Healthcare Committee is meeting on September 19th.
All right. Thank you. All right. Any public comments? Eric.
Thank you. Eric Madsen. I'd just like to add a couple of details to supplement the provost's comments earlier at the beginning on these electronic processes that we're looking at. One is that I would point out that both the electronic course evaluation discussion and the electronic activities report were a result of collaborations between the Faculty Senate and the provost's office. For example, there was a Faculty Senate motion in May of 12 that UAF adopt the Faculty 180, which is the activity report system, on a pilot basis. I have to say the company has been very, very good to work with. Right now, we sort of had the best of both worlds in the sense that they gave us the cost benefit of a long-term contract with an escape clause if it's something that we just find we simply can't live with. The launch memo should have gone out by the listserv to all faculty members. I hope that you received that. If you did not, then consolidated on the provost's AAR webpage, you'll find the launch memo, the login link, a navigation guide that the company prepared, and information about two training webinars that are coming up this Friday and the following Monday. And if you'd like to attend in person, those will both be in Rasmussen 340, no registration required. If you want to attend remotely from your office or field station or who knows where you may be, you can do that, but you need to register for that part of it. Let me just reiterate what the provost said, that the use of Faculty 180 this fall is entirely voluntary, but it would be definitely to all of our advantage to have as many people participate as possible so that you can provide feedback and we can make a good decision about if we... I'm not anticipating that we won't continue it, but if it turns out that it's a bad thing, then that we do have that option. But more importantly, to refine it so that it works for us. I would ask you to look at that memo because there are a lot of details in there about the system that we probably shouldn't take time to to go over now. Maybe the most important is that the provost is convening a faculty advisory committee and suggestions about refining the system, identifying the things that just weren't working, will flow through that committee. So please consider serving there. Around the electronic
course evaluation. The Senate is working through faculty development on that. Last year, Franz Meyer and I co-chaired that committee. We previewed 12 systems and then decided that there were four that were least worth coming back to look at again this year in a more intensive way. Those have all been scheduled. As far as we're concerned, I think all questions are on the table. What type of systems are out there that are available? Are there any of them, whether hybrid, paper, electronic, some other combination, that are right for UAF? And Franz last year pointed out one good thing. Maybe we really need to talk a little bit about the purpose of any kind of a course evaluation system at UAF. Is it primarily to feed into promotion and tenure files, for example? Is it primarily to improve instruction? So that maybe we can't answer these other questions about what type of systems work best for us until we're clear on our own minds why we're doing it at all. So that might be something to think about. Note that the report and executive summary, Jane was kind enough to post those over on that left-hand column on the UF Faculty Senate homepage underneath all of your smiling faces. So it's a very convenient place to get all of that. The report that FDAI submitted last spring and the executive summary of that report and the login information, the dates, and the login information for the four demonstrations this fall. All of those, again, you can attend remotely. Three have been scheduled or set up to do it that way. There's one that we're still working on. But it's really important that we include our off-campus and rural colleagues, so those will be absolutely live cast. So I guess for information about the AAR, go to the provost webpage for the most consolidated information about the electronic course evaluation process, the Faculty Senate front page. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. And I'll just reiterate that the Faculty 180 rep will be here at the October Senate meeting. We'll also have, I think we're going to try to do some sort of a workshop afterwards, although that'll be too late for this year's annual activity reports. But
well, there will be, in addition to the two webinars that are designed primarily for training for people who would like to consider using the system for the October 2nd report, while the faculty rep is here on campus, there will be about an hour and a half open meeting. The nature of that meeting, we can decide with the participants, whether it's a question and answer, whether it's another training. So she's willing to do anything, and we'll decide whether you want to have it right after the Senate meeting or at some other time.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Eric.
But Eric, that's for people who will use it in 2014, right? When it's
speak in the microphone. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
I'm asking Eric if that's for people who will use the electronic report in 2014 when it's mandatory.
You mean the representatives visit October 7 through 9? Yes. Everything in the next 2 weeks is going to focus on people who choose to use it voluntarily. After that, we're going to kind of shift. For example, we know that we still have to design another form for CES. We still need to get together the list of administrative access so that deans, directors, administrative assistants can get in there to make this whole thing work. We need to get the department structure underneath the unit structure so that if some of you who are chairs of departments or members of departments want to use that for your own purposes, you'll be able to. So there's work to do. But we were hoping that by getting it up and going, we can start getting feedback and accomplish that other work.
All right. Thank you, Eric.
Thanks.
Okay. Any other public comment? Seeing none. Members' comments? Are there any committees that want to report anything? Good. Okay. I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
We are adjourned. Thank you.